to a battle with the UK Bear Trust. Let's settle this once and for all. My name is Courtney Patton, and I'm the co-chair of BHBA's Trust and Estate section. Before we begin, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors, including the Sanborn team, Bond Services of California, Liberty Mutual Surety, California Title Company, and Pickford Escrow Company. Now, I'm delighted to introduce today's speakers, Laura Zwicker and Stephanie Lipson. Laura chairs Greenberg Glusker's Private Client Services Group, advising individuals and families on international and domestic tax and estate planning issues and business succession planning. Laura's practice focuses primarily on counseling ultra-high net worth individuals and their families in connection with domestic and international estate and tax planning issues and business succession planning, advising financial institutions with regard to fiduciary and custodial issues, forming, advising, and dissolving nonprofit organizations, and probate and post-death trust administration. Stephanie is a partner in the Private Client Services Group at Greenberg Glusker, where she leads the Family Office Advisory Practice. She provides comprehensive tax counsel to domestic and international families, family offices, real estate and tech entrepreneurs, high-profile entertainment figures, private investors, and closely held business owners in all aspects of personal wealth and succession planning. Stephanie advises on proactive wealth transfer, income and property tax planning strategies, pre-liquidity transaction planning, and pre- and post-death administration. She has focused expertise in generation skipping transfer tax, S-corp planning, California real property tax, privacy structures, and cross-border trust planning and residency issues. And with that, I will turn it over to Laura and Stephanie.
Thank you so much, Courtney. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today and spending a little bit of time with us on a battle with the UK Bear Trust. Let's settle this once and for all. I'm Stephanie Lipson, here today with my partner, Laura Zwicker, and we are really looking forward to talking with you folks on this topic today. So we're going to tell you a lot about what we about this topic, but there's a few things that we want to sort of say at the outset about this topic and the intersection between U.S. law and U.K. law.
Right. So to provide context, Stephanie and I are both California qualified lawyers. Neither of us is qualified in the UK. So what we're giving you here is a high level overview of UK inheritance tax laws so that you have context and can understand how the treaty interplays with domestic law in the US and in the UK. So there are many, many nuances to UK law that we are not covering. We do, I believe, have participating today, Robert Broderick from Payne Hicks Beach in London. And to the extent we need to call in an expert, we will send him an email and he'll give us the answer, no doubt. So just keeping in mind that there are many, many things that we are not going to cover. So please don't take this as a comprehensive or complete summary of UK gift and inheritance tax law. We will not be talking, we're focusing mainly on the changes that came into effect at 6th of April of this year relating to the inheritance tax. So we're not covering any income tax changes. We are also not covering any of the business property relief changes or agricultural property relief changes in the UK, really focused on the inheritance tax and how it interacts with trusts that straddle the two jurisdictions.
So with that, let's go ahead and get started. Just a very quick overview for you, also very high level on the U.S. estate and gift tax system. Of course, we have an exclusion against U.S. estate and gift tax of this year, $13.99 million. That's for every U.S. citizen and U.S. resident. And when we talk about resident in this context, we're not talking about the income tax residency test. We're talking about somebody who is considered domiciled in the U.S. For the amounts over that $13.99 million, which of course is a unified exclusion between lifetime gifting and transfers on death, it will be a 40% tax, and that is assessed against the worldwide assets. For somebody who's non-US, non-US citizen, non-US resident, They will only be taxable on US situs assets, but there's also only a $60,000 exclusion before the 40% estate tax will apply. US gives an unlimited marital deduction for outright transfers or transfers into a qualified marital trust for a US citizen spouse. We can, of course, also get the benefit of a marital deduction upon death to a non-citizen spouse using a qualified domestic trust structure. But during lifetime, gifts to a non-citizen spouse will be limited this year, $190,000 annually with an inflation adjustment. And then, of course, we also have our unlimited charitable deduction for transfers to a qualified charity. That's, of course, during lifetime or upon death.
So we'll start out like many things between the US and UK. We think we're on the same track, and then it turns out the tracks have diverged at some point. So there is a 40% inheritance tax in the UK, but their credit, which they call the nil rate band, is only £325,000. And even though the pound is much stronger than the dollar, stronger every day, it still doesn't get us anywhere near close to the $14 million credit that we have in the US. That applies now after the 6th of April to UK long-term residents who are persons who are income tax resident under UK domestic law for 10 out of the last 20 years, and then would apply to people who cease to be long-term resident in the UK with a tail that varies or decreases over the increases over the length of time you've been long-term resident. So here's where we vary even more. When a settlement is made on a trust, when you contribute assets to a trust that is viewed as a real trust for UK inheritance tax purposes, there's an immediate 20% charge when the assets are contributed to the trust and a 6% charge every 10 years. And then on top of that, if it's kind of like a revocable trust, you thought it was a revocable trust for US purposes, and you got caught in this trap, there would be an additional 40% charge if the settlor has an interest at death. So you can tell this is a very different method of taxing trusts than we see in the US. Once a trust has been caught in this net, it will be subject to this UK inheritance tax, a 6% charge every year, every 10 years for the trust's entire duration. That isn't something that just exists while the settlor has an interest. Like the US, there is inheritance tax relief for transfers to spouses. We're going to cover the nuances of that a little bit later, and relief for gifts or bequests to UK registered charities. And again, we'll focus on that a little bit more later.
So the question is, what's different now as a result of the changes, the UK tax law changes? And under the prior UK tax regime, which was really focused on domicile, there were these concepts called domicile of origin and domicile of choice, and it wasn't this long-term residency test. And so now, and often we were concerned when working with a client in the US, if they had ties and connections to the UK, whether they were going to still be considered to have domicile in the UK, where we needed to be concerned that funding a trust here in the US, particularly just a revocable trust used primarily for probate avoidance purposes, was somehow going to trigger a UK inheritance charge if the trust was deemed a settlement. So now where we have somebody who was otherwise a UK domicile and has moved to the US, perhaps it's a little bit clearer under these new laws whether or not you still need to be concerned about a UK inheritance tax charge as to whether or not the US revocable trust is going to be a settlement or the alternative of being a bearer trust. Today, we're focused on the other of these two, which is the circumstance where you have someone who's a US person, for example, a US citizen, and they are domiciled or they have been US domiciled, but they spend a lot of time in the UK. And under the prior rules, perhaps you weren't concerned about whether or not they were going to be subject to UK inheritance tax other than with respect to UK situs assets. But under these new rules, the question is, are they going to be considered long-term resident and have they been long-term resident there for a long enough period where there's actually now a question of dual taxation in the other way? So just to be clear, today's presentation is really primarily focused on sort of the basic US revocable trust structure and how these rules interplay with that. Not so much focused on transfers to irrevocable gifting structures here in the US.
All right. So I was talking to an English lawyer last week, and we're talking about a bunch of different structures and saying, well, we're not sure what that means under our law. And she said, well, but I know exactly what a trust is. And I said, oh, really? Because I'm not sure I know what a trust is in England, because what I think a trust is something different than what you seem to think a trust is. So a bare trust is what we used to hope for and dream for when we had clients who had a domicile of origin in the UK, and we weren't sure whether they had broken that domicile of origin, which would have tied them back to the UK inheritance tax. And what I've found working with many different wonderful tax lawyers and private client lawyers in the UK is they all have a slightly different definition of what a bare trust is and what their comfort level is in terms of the terms of the settlement or the trust deed or the trust document, and what powers can be retained and can't be retained. And what you see here is sort of a compilation of what advice we've gotten from different English lawyers. And even something as simple as a privacy trust, we found that some English lawyers can't get comfortable with, even though for us, it's really just a nominee arrangement. So you see on the left-hand side, the sort of technical definition of what a bare trust is. And the practical advice that we've gotten is we have to have the settlor plus someone who can act on behalf of the settlor, even in the case of incapacity, who has the full powers with respect to the trust, the power to amend, revoke, withdraw. And we need to be sure that the trustee's duties are not owed to anyone other than the settlor during the time that we want a trust to be a bare trust. So, you know, this is something that we were constantly working with and striving toward when we were dealing with UK connected people in the US. And maybe we don't need to worry about it anymore now that we have the more certain long-term residence test, and we'll know either we care because they are still in the tail period, or we don't care anymore because they're outside the tail period and we don't have any exposure to UK inheritance tax.
So one thing to note here, again, so slightly off topic from where we're going in this presentation, but to the extent that you do have US-UK connected clients that you've been working with and they had unfunded revocable trusts because there was a concern about whether or not it would be a transfer and deemed a settlement in the UK, as a result of the changes in the UK law, it's probably a good idea to go back and work with UK counsel to understand whether they would be long-term resident at this point in time, whether any of those tails would apply to them in terms of when a UK inheritance tax charge could still apply if they were to transfer assets to a US revocable trust, and decide whether or not there's additional planning for that group of clients that these changes implicate, where there's perhaps something that can be done on a go-forward basis that couldn't have been before. But we'll sort of focus on the other. So Laura, what happens if it becomes a settlement?
So what happens if it becomes a settlement is we fall into that inheritance tax charge that we just discussed. If we have a transfer to a trust that we're thinking is just a simple, everyday, plain vanilla revocable trust, and the UK tax authorities disagree and say, no, you settled assets on a real trust, not a bare trust, there would be the 20% inheritance tax charge at the time of settlement and a 6% charge on the fair market value of the assets every 10 years. And then since it's a standard plain vanilla revocable trust, our settlor is going to have an interest in the trust at death. So the assets will be exposed again to the 40% inheritance tax at the time of death. And the trust, as it continues on, because it was exposed once to the UK inheritance tax, is going to be subject to that 6% charge every 10 years for the duration of the trust's existence. And this would be the case for a long-term resident's worldwide assets, even if the contributions were made before they were long-term resident, unless we get some magic treatment under the treaty. There was a category of trust called excluded property trusts that people often funded before they became UK tax resident or deemed domiciled in the UK. Those trusts went away under the new law. So you, if you know about those, you can just forget about them and know that they're subject to tax.
So let's talk a little bit about tax and what happens if you sort of fall into this situation where the US is going to assess its tax and the UK is going to assess its inheritance tax. So there are really two potential routes that we look at. One of them is going to be whether or not their statutory credit would be sufficient under the circumstances. And that's the statutory credit provided by under US law, under the Internal Revenue Code. And then, of course, the alternative is whether or not a treaty position and treaty relief is going to be more favorable. It is an either or. You do not get the statutory credit and treaty relief. But sometimes the statutory credit can be sufficient under circumstances. Most times that's going to be because the basis of taxation is simply going to be the situs that there's property situs in another jurisdiction that is being taxed by that jurisdiction. So if both countries would seek to impose tax on the worldwide assets of the decedent, then often the statutory credit is unlikely to get you far enough for where you want to go. So very briefly, certainly not the focus of today's conversation, but important for context, is that there is a statutory credit under U.S. law. It is against foreign death tax. That is does not apply to the gift tax, just to be clear. It is applicable to a U.S. citizen or resident. Again, remember we're talking about when we use the term resident in this context, a domiciliary. Where both U.S. and the foreign country would impose a tax. It is a foreign death tax that is actually paid. It has to be with respect to property that is situated in that foreign country and property that's includable in the decedent's gross estate. So, for example, sort of in a very basic example, if somebody owns a property in the UK, but as a US citizen, the US is going to tax the decedent's worldwide assets, but the UK would also seek to tax the UK situs property. The statutory credit would potentially be available in that circumstance. It's also available for substantially equivalent taxes, so it doesn't have to be identical. Obviously, there's differences between inheritance taxes and the U.S. estate and gift tax. The key factor is really going to be whether or not it's being the tax is imposed on the value of the property that is being transferred from the decedent to the beneficiary. But again, where the statutory credit is going to be helpful is going to be in specific circumstances, such as the example I gave.
All right, so we're inching toward the treaty. So you see below, and we've really covered already how each of the U.S. and the U.K. Determine under domestic law whether they have a right to tax. So in the U.S., it's whether you're a citizen or a domiciliary, and this is as Stephanie has already said, domiciliary is a subjective test looking at all the facts and circumstances, whereas citizenship, that's easy. We should be able to know that. For the UK, we no longer have the subjective domicile test, but we have a fairly clear test based on whether you have been a long-term resident under UK domestic income tax rules. Now, that test itself may have some subjectivity, but whether you are a long-term resident or not will have been determined fairly objectively. So, while this is a purely domestic test, it is actually the gateway to the treaty. We'll see in a minute that we use this domestic test to determine as a first point whether there is crediting available under the treaty. And as Stephanie was saying, as is true for the statutory crediting test, under the treaty, you need to have matching taxes, and you need to not have a disconnect in timing in order for you to get relief under the treaty. So, for example, the 20% entry charge into a revocable trust that we would view as a revocable trust in the US, we probably don't have a matching tax in the US because there would be no gift tax going into a purely revocable trust. Well, whereas if the UK viewed this trust as a settlement rather than a bear trust, we would have that 20% charge and there would be no help coming from the treaty because we don't have two taxes being imposed at the same time. Similarly, if you had a completed gift for UK purposes, you would have a capital gains tax imposed rather than a gift tax. So again, the question is, are those substantially similar taxes that would be available for crediting under the treaty? So let's move into the treaty. Get ready.
So before we dive deep into the US-UK estate tax treaty, we're going to give you just provide a little bit of context, because I think often there is a sense of sort of going in through the looking glass when you are immersed in the treaty and the language of the treaty itself. So first of all, the US has 15 existing estate tax, death tax treaties. Within the treaties, when we talk about countries or jurisdictions, the treaty uses the term contracting states, the two states who have come together to form the treaty. But they're really not ever called, they're not called treaties. You'll hear conventions, bilateral agreements, double tax agreements. Those are used both in sort of conventional conversation about these treaties, as well as in the language of the treaty themselves. Rarely are they actually identified in the language as treaties. So there's two different types, two categories of treaties, really. The older category of treaties is what are referred to as situs-based treaties. So just as a preview, the US-UK treaty is a domicile-based treaty. The situs-based treaties were really focused on assigning jurisdiction to tax, really on an asset-by-asset basis, by creating rules for where assets are going to be considered situs for tax purposes. It's not about the taxpayer's connection or affiliation, domicile, residence, nationality, with the jurisdiction. So domicile-based treaties really start from the perspective of focusing on personal affiliation, essentially what we've been talking about here, where the very similar to the domestic law issue of the US has its domestic law where it has jurisdiction to tax, and the UK has jurisdiction based on its domestic law to tax. It starts there, but also has a scheme for determining domicile under the treaty itself, which is often referred to as fiscal domicile. Where fiscal domicile would be assigned to both of them under the rules, then there is a series of tie-breaking rules to determine which jurisdiction gets priority jurisdiction to tax. But even separate from that, there is then a category that it looks a lot like the situs-based treaties, where there are specific categories of assets, most commonly what they call immovable property, real property, or permanent establishment, which is often referring to a business with fixed base of operation, that are going to be taxed on a situs basis in terms of which country, which jurisdiction has priority jurisdiction to tax. Then there are a series of different credits that are applied. There are provisions for how deductions are going to be taken into account, whether those are expenses, whether those are the marital deductions, charitable deductions, as we were talking about. And then the other thing to just keep in mind is that, generally speaking, these are going to be applied to national taxes. It's not going to apply to state and local taxes. So in California, we don't have a California state estate tax, but certainly in other jurisdictions within the U.S. that we do. The treaty is really a U.S.-UK arrangement and is not going to address those state taxes.
And just before we leave this, there's some more terminology that you might want to know about. So you'll hear about the treaty and the protocols. So it sounds like the protocol is like how you engage with the treaty or something
very official,
specific, very official and very specific. Turns out it just means amendment. So if there's been an amendment to a treaty, it's the protocol. And then there is always a technical explanation that goes with the treaty. That's the official technical explanation. And each country will issue their own technical explanation in their own language. So that is always the first place to start understanding the treaty, is it gives you some explanation in plain language. The other thing to know about treaties is there is very, very, very little guidance. It's very frustrating because they use all these terms that could mean a bunch of things in a bunch of different contexts, and there is very little guidance. So we start with the technical explanation, then we might go to the OECD model treaty and its explanation. And often the OECD model treaties in the gift and estate tax area don't have very much in the terms of, in terms of explanation. So we may look to the OECD model income tax treaty and its explanation, but then concepts don't really translate between income tax and gift and estate tax. And that's true in the treaty context as well. Sometimes there'll be some IRS rulings, very few in the treaty area. Sometimes there'll be some tax court cases, but again, very few. So we may look to cases from countries who are completely unconnected to this particular question that we have about this particular US-UK treaty provision, just to try to get a little bit more guidance. So not only is the language of the treaty dense and using language that we might understand one way in normal English, and in fact, it has another meaning, but there is very, very little guidance. So a lot of fun when you're dealing with the treaty.
I think that even holds true with the official title of the US-UK Estate Tax Treaty, which we've provided here just for context. The convention between the government of the United States of America and the government of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland for the avoidance of double taxation and prevention of fiscal evasion. It sounds very sordid. With respect to taxes on estates of deceased persons and on gifts. And you can see that it's been around since entered into force in 1979.
And this is just so you get a sense of the sort of structure of the treaty, the US-UK treaty. And you'll find if you're looking across other domicile-based treaties that their structure is going to be very similar. So the language tends to be similar and the structure tends to be similar. But from treaty to treaty, because these are actually negotiated between two countries, it isn't like the IRS putting out its own interpretation. This is actually negotiated language. There'll be differences and there'll be subtle differences. And you'll wonder, why does this treaty leave out this particular word in its definition of permanent establishment? And this one has it in, and what is the significance? Often there's not a lot of guidance. But anyway, the one other thing I wanted to say on this page is the US-UK treaty and a few other treaties, including the US-France treaty, say that they cover generation skipping transfer tax, but then it doesn't seem to fit into the way we think about generation skipping transfer tax. So to the extent that you have a tax issue, a double tax issue involving generation skipping transfer tax, don't feel too comfortable if you find that your treaty does include that, because it may not provide you a clear answer.
And oftentimes, it's going to be difficult in terms of finding a match with timing of when a tax might be imposed. So we're spending a lot of time focused on really understanding sort of the structure of the treaty and where these come together. We pulled this from the technical explanation from the US-UK Estate Tax Treaty, because ultimately I think it's important that we kind of understand so much is focused on domicile. The old UK rules were focused on domicile. The US focuses on domicile when it's not a bright line citizenship test. The treaty is going to be focused on the term that used is fiscal domicile, but very similar in terms of the different conversations and tests that are being applied. And so the question is, why does that matter? And the technical explanation makes it clear that it's the country that is of domicile that is going to have primary jurisdiction to tax based on worldwide assets, other than with respect to those CITES-based assets. And it's not that that it does not mean that the country, the non-situs country, doesn't have a right to tax. It's who has priority right to tax and which country is going to be required to provide crediting based on tax imposed if there is in fact going to be dual taxation. So with that context in mind, we are going to in fact go down into the treaty now.
I'm going to interrupt Stephanie for one quick
okay.
before we move forward. So we've been talking about the fact that there's been this change on April 6th as to how the UK imposes taxing jurisdiction or takes taxing jurisdiction. And instead of focusing on domicile, we're now focused on long-term residence. Clearly, the US-UK treaty has not been renegotiated between April 6th and today, but there has been informal guidance from the UK government that for now, they will sort of use the term long-term resident in place of domicile when they're interpreting the application of the treaty to the UK inheritance tax.
So under the treaty, Article 4 is where we're going to find the fiscal domicile provisions, as well as then the tie-breaking provisions if it turns out that you have fiscal domicile or domicile under the treaty in both jurisdictions, at least as a starting place. So this is a place where I think sometimes it's easy to get a little bit turned around. I know I have on occasion and had to sort of step back and then step back in. We applied our domicile tests before when we were talking about domestic law, but the starting place under the treaty is going to be applying domicile according to the domestic laws of each jurisdiction. So that sounds a little bit confusing in some ways because we already did that, which is why we're looking at the treaty. But there is particularly, especially with the US, a distinction because we're not applying the test for jurisdiction to tax, right? In the US, we talked about the US having jurisdiction to tax based on either citizenship or US residency domicile. Here, we really are only focused on the domicile test. So whereas before, if you had a US citizen that was subject to taxation by the US on their worldwide assets because of citizenship, we no longer are looking at that bright line test for that particular individual. We are, in fact, applying the domicile-based test, even though they are a US citizen. And so under the US, we have various rulings, court rulings, helping us to understand and apply the subjective facts and circumstances test of domicile, but it is facts and circumstances. So whether somebody is living there for a brief period of time with no definite present intention of removing therefrom, the true fixed permanent home and place of habitation, where they would return to after having been absent. Generally, a US-born individual who has domicile here is going to remain domiciled here unless it can be really truly established that they have decided to live permanently somewhere else and indefinitely in a new country of residence. So that is where we start from as far as domestic law. But under the treaty, there are some additional provisions. And we understand that under the treaty, somebody will be considered to have US domicile if they are in fact domiciled under US domestic law, under the test above. Or if they were domiciled, they're a US citizen and they were domiciled under the above test at any time in the 3 years prior to the date. So you sort of get a 3 year window where you keep that US domicile as far as the treaty is concerned. As Laura has said, under the UK, there's a bit of right now the guidance that's out is letting us know that the long-term residency can be is being used as an approximation for somebody who has UK domicile. So if under the treaty test with these sort of additional considerations, you have somebody who is nonetheless still considered domiciled in the US and domiciled in the UK as far as the treaty is concerned, then you're going to have to utilize the tie-breaking rules of the treaty to determine which country is going to have priority jurisdiction if you're taking a treaty position in terms of who has the right to tax.
Right. So in both cases, and we'll start with the US, if you are not a UK national, but you are a US citizen, you will be deemed to be domiciled under the treaty, or you'll be, your treaty domicile, since we have to break the tie, will be the US if you have not been income tax resident in the UK for 7 or more of the preceding 10 years. And similarly, if you're not a US citizen, but you are a UK national, you will be treaty domiciled in the UK if you have not been income tax resident in the US for more than seven of the next of the last 10 years. So often for our clients who haven't just moved somewhere, we're going to fall outside of this tiebreaker one test, and we're going to have to look farther down the list. And so the next test, which is sort of, these are separate but combined into tiebreaker two, we will look at the country where an individual has a permanent home available. Now that sounds super clear, right? We have a permanent home available. But when the treaty has been interpreted, it turns out that the home doesn't really need to be that permanent, and it doesn't need to be what we think of as a home. It has to be a place where you can go freely. So it can't necessarily be like a hotel room, but it's a place where you can go freely that's sort of held open for you. And the most recent U.S. tax court case on this was a Pod versus Commissioner. It's a 1998 case looking at the U.S.-Canada income tax treaty. And they found that having a room in the family home in Montreal where there were some personal items, as well as sort of a home office and some cars, that was a permanent home. But there was also a permanent home in the U.S., where the taxpayer went to, which was his fiance's home, owned by his fiance, where he had a fax machine set up. So to me, if I read this and said permanent home, I wouldn't think of either one of those as being the permanent home. So it's more complicated than the language of the treaty would let on. Not objective, actually quite subjective. And if using that sort of subjective test, you learn that the person has a permanent home available to them in both the US and the UK, which is going to be the case much of the time with our clients. Then you're going to look at the country where the individual's center of vital interests is located. That sounds something very technical and like we should have a treasury regulation that tells us what the center of vital interests is, but we don't. And this test is actually even more subjective than the permanent home test. And you're going to look at where the family connections are, where social relations are, where their occupation is carried out, where their political and cultural activities take place, their place of business, their driver's license, their health insurance. And, you know, there, so not only is it sort of like our domicile test, we look at this whole litany of different connections. It's not clear, and different countries have come out differently, whether your business connections should be the most important or whether your personal connections should be most important. So likely for any client who's spending any significant amount of time in both jurisdictions, it's not going to be clear where their center of vital interest is located. And if that's the case, then we go down to the next prong of the tiebreaker and look at where their habitual abode was located. So again, that sounds very clear and objective, but it's not. And, you know, maybe a little bit clearer than center of vital interest, you're going to be looking at where the frequency and duration of their time spent is. So it's very much a durational test. You want to look at where they're spending the most time. And that may be very difficult, especially if they're spending time in the US, the UK, and several other jurisdictions. Where is their habitual abode? The nice thing about the next prong is it's clear. if we can't figure out where they have a permanent home or they have a permanent home in both places, and we can't figure out where their center of vital interest is, and we can't figure out where their habitual abode is or whether, you know, there is one habitual abode or two, we then come down to which country are they a national of? And in most cases, that will be the end of our journey. But unfortunately, we have many clients with dual or more nationalities, mm-hmm. and then we are left with
competent authority. where you are essentially turning it over to a different governing body under the treaty from the two jurisdictions to determine really how to break this tie. And never mind, obviously, that you know you can't necessarily know how that's going to be resolved. Just as a practical matter, being able to make plans and plan for both for reporting purposes, for tax purposes, timing purposes, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. And so we really do, when we have a situation with a client where these first two series of tie-breaking tests are not clear, the question really becomes, are there steps that can be taken to make it clearer? If you have somebody who is spending a lot of time in multiple jurisdictions or has multiple nationalities, what ties and connections can be focused on so that you do not end up in a scenario where you are reliant on the competent authority determination in order to break the tie on which jurisdiction is going to have priority to tax. But it is very, very much going to be facts and circumstances. So not so much facts and circumstances, a little bit more bright line are the two categories that assign priority jurisdiction to tax, not based on domicile, but actually based on situs of assets. So even though this is a domicile-based treaty, as we said, there are these two categories of assets, the first of which is referred to as immovable property. I just sort of think of it categorically as real property, but that does apply to a broader category than just the sort of land or building. It does not include ships, boats, aircraft, doesn't include debt secured by mortgage. But even in this category, there is sometimes going to be ambiguity, certainly where we have an entity interposed and the entity owns real property. That's going to raise questions about what situs jurisdiction is. I'm going to turn it over to give enough time to Laura on permanent establishment, which is certainly a much more in-depth conversation.
And we're going to go through this fairly quickly so that we can get to the end and talk about settlements. So permanent establishment is kind of a mystery wrapped in a riddle. So we know that a permanent establishment is a fixed place of business through which the business of an enterprise is wholly or partly carried on. Okay, again, that seems like it's clear enough. And then the treaty goes on to be super helpful and says it includes especially a branch, an office, a factory, a workshop, and a mine, an oil or gas well, a quarry, any other place of extraction of natural resources. And they're again super helpful to tell us what it is not. So it will not include the use of facilities solely for the purpose of storage, display, or delivery of goods or merchandise, the maintenance of stock, solely for the purpose of storage and display, or for the purpose of processing by another enterprise, and on, with these things that seem very specific to a certain set of activities and not applicable to what most of our clients are engaged in. And then when you start looking at the technical explanations and the cases and rulings interpreting what a permanent establishment is, both in the gift and estate tax context and in the income tax context, it becomes even more unclear. You don't actually need an owned or rented premises in order to have a fixed place of business. A certain amount of space at your disposal is determined to be a place of business. But you do have to actually be carrying on business at that place. Examples have been given in case law where you have, for example, a catering business that is providing catering services for a film crew. That will be a permanent establishment because they're going to the same place every day for a specific period of time to provide these services. I wouldn't have guessed from reading the treaty that a catering service for a film crew that's on site for 3 weeks would be a permanent establishment, but it is.
So Laura, let me ask a question. When we have certainly had this question come up when a client wants to be clear that any permanent establishment is here in the US, for example, and they say, well, how about I just rent an office? I mean, you know, we can have an office, we can keep the records there. I mean, I don't ever plan to go there. I don't need to use it. I mean, I just do my business wherever I need to take care of my business, and where I am is where I do my business. Would that give us a permanent establishment in the US?
It feels like it wouldn't. It is a place of business, but you're not doing business there, right? None of the business is happening there. On the flip side, where we have clients who have companies of some sort, and to try to make sure that their permanent establishment is maintained in the US, they've elected officers and directors who are physically located in the US, and they haven't retained any authority in the governing instruments to transact business on behalf of this enterprise. But in fact, the client is negotiating agreements, entering into binding contracts, signing binding contracts in the UK. You know, I think that that exposes us to a permanent establishment in the UK because they're probably doing this in their home or some other space where they regularly go. And even though we've said the permanent establishment of this business is in the US, and here are the people who are sitting in this office doing this work, so it isn't even an empty office, but actually the full authority is somewhere else. And there is some interpretation of the permanent establishment provision that found that where you have a person who has authority to talk about business, but they don't have final authority. You need sign off from the home office in LA to enter into the contract. In fact, someone in the home office in LA has to actually enter into the contract, has to sign it. If you have basically done everything that needs to be done other than sign off, the permanent establishment will be where all of that activity is occurring, not where the final sign off is. So, where you're trying to stay out of a country in order to avoid a permanent establishment there, you not only need to have the sort of facade of being in the US, you actually have to be disciplined and be sure that you aren't actually conducting the business, you aren't actually doing the negotiation in the country you're trying to stay out of.
So we're going to move ahead and go a little bit quicker through some of the taxing provisions under the treaty and where deductions are and potential double taxation, so that we can, as Laura said, get to the question of the bear trust versus the settlement, all of which this leads up to, we promise. So under Article 5 of the US-UK treaty is where we're going to see the assignment of the priority jurisdictions to tax, basically. And there are reciprocal provisions for the US versus UK. Basically, the fiscal domicile that's determined is going to have priority jurisdiction to tax, except for those situs-based assets under Article 6 and 7, the immovable property and the permanent establishment. If you are fiscal domicile, that jurisdiction will have the ability to tax worldwide assets. The situs location will have the right up under priority jurisdiction to tax the situs base, but that does not mean the other jurisdiction is not allowed to tax. There are just going to be required crediting under Article 9 of the treaty. But before we can even get to the crediting under the treaty, we need to understand how much tax is really going to be imposed. And just like under US domestic law, we need to first address potential deductions and also the opportunity for mismatches between the two jurisdictions. So Article 8 is where we will find the deductions under the treaty and how, and that's going to include also expenses. But today we're just going to very briefly focus on the marital deduction and the charitable deduction in order to understand both where there is not necessarily alignment under the domestic laws, but also where the treaty may not actually provide relief. And either there is a potential for double tax, or this settlement exception, where applicable, could be very valuable and helpful in avoiding this mismatch. So Article 8 tells us, in determining the amount on which tax is to be computed, it's going to permit deductions basically under the domestic law of each state. That is going to be the starting place, just as it was in terms of determining domicile. But then there is a treaty overlay. So as we know, under US domestic law, there is an unlimited deduction for transfers outright or in a qualified trust for a US citizen spouse that applies during lifetime or upon death. We only have a transfer to a qualified domestic trust upon death for a non-citizen spouse, or the lifetime annual transfer of up to $190,000 with an inflation adjustment to again for a non-citizen spouse.
And in the UK, somewhat similar to the US, but slightly different, where both spouses have the same domicile, then the spousal exemption for UK inheritance tax is unlimited. However, where you have a disconnect, where the deceased spouse is UK domiciled, but or long-term resident, and the surviving spouse is not, then the spouse exemption is limited to an additional £325,000, and which may be reduced by lifetime gifts if death occurs within 7 years.
So the treaty then has its own overlay of how it is going to provide and allow deductions depending upon sort of which fact pattern it is. And we're not going to go through each of them in this today, but the couple important takeaways for today is just because it qualifies under domestic law, it doesn't mean there's going to be reciprocity under the treaty to the full amount. And so you can see, for example, under certain UK circumstances, there's only going to be potentially 50%. As Laura and I were thinking about this and talking about this, one of the things we also were recognizing is that the US-UK estate tax treaty was put into effect. It was signed in 78 and put into effect in 79. And you know, we didn't have an unlimited marital deduction at that point in time. And so certainly US domestic law has also changed since the time that this was put into effect. And so one thing to keep in mind is if you have somebody who is exposed to both US tax and UK tax, saying that the estate or the trust is going entirely to the surviving spouse does not necessarily mean everything is fine, no problem, we don't need to worry about it, because how those marital deductions get applied could be different depending upon, you know, again, whether you are looking at it on the US side or on the UK side, and then how the treaty applies. And if there isn't also, if there isn't a full offset, so for example, if you are limited to the 50% deduction, but got 100% on the US side, as an example, then there is going to be a section that is subject to tax that maybe you are not expecting, but also there's no offset because it's not subject to tax by both jurisdictions. It's only being taxed by one jurisdiction. So this is on the marital side, but we also want to cover briefly today on the charitable deduction side.
Right. And just as Stephanie was saying on the marital side, just because you're saying everything's going to charity doesn't mean everything's great. You don't need to worry if you have US and UK connections. So in the UK, there's only charitable relief for gifts going to UK registered charities. And the UK taxing authorities do not have the same substantial equivalency process, in the US, when we're looking at giving to non-US charities, we can say, okay, as long as that charity is substantially equivalent to what a US qualified charity would be, we're going to be okay. So going from the US side, we're much more likely to get a charitable deduction for gifts made to non-US charities than you are in the UK. So if we're giving everything to Cedars-Sinai, it is unlikely that that gift would qualify for charitable relief from UK inheritance tax, because Cedars-Sinai is clearly not a registered charity in the UK. So what can you do if you have a very charitably inclined client who we think is going to be UK long-term resident and therefore exposed to UK inheritance tax on their worldwide assets? You can look at giving to just UK registered charities, which may not be consistent with their wishes. You can look to dual qualified donor advised funds, and there are several out there who are US and UK qualified. And that is a simple, fairly easy, very low cost option, as long as the client's comfortable with that. Then if you have a very significant client with very charitable intentions, you could look at creating a custom structure that would qualify in both jurisdictions, or you can look at a friends of organization so that you're getting your full charitable deduction and you don't have that surprise of having tax that's not eliminated by the treaty because it's only being imposed by one jurisdiction.
Right. And that's ultimately, we've covered a lot of the concept of crediting against double tax and the timing of the tax. But that's ultimately, sort of what the takeaway is. You really do need to have a situation in order for the tax crediting to apply where both countries are at the same time imposing their tax. And certainly you're only going to get crediting to the extent that the rate of tax up to the rate of tax. So if one country is imposing tax at 20% and the other is imposing it at 40%, it's not eliminating entirely the double tax. You'll get credited for the 20% or vice versa, depending upon which direction you're going. But in these examples where you have a marital deduction mismatch or a charitable deduction mismatch, and one country is not imposing a tax and the other country is, there isn't a double tax to credit. And that's the important component to take away. So let's take a look at under this sort of new scenario with the long-term residency where we in the UK, where we have a little bit more clarity under certain circumstances. Perhaps you have a US citizen or US domiciliary who at this point in time is not UK domiciled under the treaty, but under the new long-term residency tests. Could very well become subject to become UK domiciled. And if you're concerned about going through that tiebreaker test, the US UK estate tax treaty actually has an exclusion within it for certain property that is settled into a trust. So it's transferred to a trust that is deemed a settlement from the UK's perspective. And the settlor was domiciled in the US and is not a national of the UK at the time that it settled. If you have that type of scenario, rather than focusing on our bare trust and trying to avoid having it become a settlement, it is possible that actually purposefully causing trust assets to be funded into a settlement trust in that circumstance, and I'll emphasize non-UK assets, so not Article 6 property, the immovable property, not Article 7 property, permanent establishment, UK permanent establishment property. Transferring those types of assets and settling them onto a trust while the person is US domiciliary and is not a national of the UK and is not UK domiciled would exclude it from taxation under the terms of the US UK estate tax treaty. And so, if you have that scenario and can sort of qualify this grouping of assets, and we'll talk about what that means, you can eliminate the concerns that you have about double taxation as well as the concerns when you have mismatch on the deductions, for example, on the charitable deduction or on the marital deduction. But you have to also be very careful about the type of assets that you're talking about and the circumstances of when you're funding these assets in. So, as one example, we need to think about what does it mean to make additions to the trust, particularly if the person is the reason that this is being done is because there's a concern that the individual could become UK domiciled long-term resident. And what happens if there are assets transferred after that? And so, as we look at this, you would want to, for example, sort of cut off assets going into that trust at the point that it becomes a settlement so that you don't have a taint from additional assets.
And then you need to think about what is an addition, right? So clearly, if I take an additional account and I add it to the trust, that's clearly an addition. But there are many more nuanced additions that could occur. So if you had a business entity that the client was active in, as well as having that business entity hold assets that increase in value. If the assets simply increase in value, that shouldn't be an addition to the trust. But if the value of the business entity increases as a result of additional services that the client's providing to the business entity, that likely would be an addition. And so we need to think about maybe segregating that asset or splitting the business and saying, okay, this is all historical stuff that's just going to roll in. And then any new services that you're going to provide are going to be provided through a new entity that we're not going to contribute to this. We know that these are exposed. We're not trying to protect those. We're just trying to protect what is clearly protectable. And you know, the other interesting question is, do we have a taint if we have an asset that was a permanent establishment at one point in the past and we think we've cleaned it? Do the proceeds of that continue to be a permanent establishment? So this is our culmination slide. We've come to the end, even though we're basically out of time, but we're going to talk about it for just enough time so you understand why we're so excited. So we've talked about bear trusts and UK practitioners having different definitions of different comfort levels with what's a bear trust. Now we want to know what's a settlement. And again, what you see on this slide is a compilation of advice from across a large group of UK practitioners we've worked with over the years. And it's clear that a settlement is a situation where the trustee owes fiduciary duties to the settlor and to successive trust beneficiaries. And the trustees must have sole discretion to decide to whom, when, and what distributions will be made. So clearly we have to be in a jurisdiction in the US where we can override that duty to the person with the power to revoke. So in California, under probate code 15800, we know that the trustee during the period of revocation only owes duties to the settlor. So the question is, how can we, in a way that would be valid and enforceable under California law, eliminate those? And in some jurisdictions in the US, it may be easier or less easy to do that. And we want to be sure that the settlor doesn't have sole authority as trustee, even in a fiduciary capacity. We want to ensure that there are a class of current beneficiaries in addition to the settlor to whom discretionary distributions can be made, and potentially limiting the broad powers of the settlor to amend and revoke. And none of these, there, again, there's no bright line test. We can't say, oh, we've checked these three boxes and therefore it's a settlement. And one of the things that, you know, Stephanie and I were talking about before the presentation is our revocable trusts. We started out at the beginning being told by our UK advisors, oh, these aren't bear trusts. There are all these things that are wrong with it. And we think, okay, good. As long as we leave it the way it is, then we must have a settlement. But then we turn around and talk to our UK advisors and say, no, there are these things that are wrong with it. So it turns out that what we think of as our standard revocable trust won't really work to be a bear trust and won't really work to be a settlement. And when you're dealing with cross-border clients in all sorts of circumstances, one of the most important takeaways is, talk to the client's UK advisor. Do not agree to act for a client who doesn't have a UK advisor or one who won't let you communicate, because all of this stuff is really complicated. And when we see words that we think we know what they mean, not only do they not mean the same thing in the treaty, they aren't going to mean the same thing in the other jurisdiction. So we need to all be working together to make sure that we can come up with a dictionary so that we understand what we mean when we say trust and we say settlement and we say discretion, because all of those things are going to be interpreted slightly differently.
So I think we're just about out of time for the day. We want to thank everybody for sticking with us and exploring the bear trust and settlement and this dive into the world of the US and UK estate tax treaty. We really appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you so much.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.